Good morning. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and it's your Tech Update Monday. Our guest, Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Officer at Madison College, also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center, which I hope we get to, but also your questions about tech today. How do you use artificial intelligence, and what concerns do you have about your data privacy and identity online? We invite you to the conversation this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email anytime, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Jesse, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Happy to have you in the studio today. And let's start with a recent viral trend that I have seen a lot of people doing, and that is uploading their photos into an AI system in order to generate a cartoon character of themselves, what they would look like on The Simpsons. Studio Ghibli is, as you mentioned, sort of an Japanese anime version of yourself. Or even, and I saw this in a news story, an action figure of yourself built around your hobbies and proclivities. Describe this social media trend for us, Jesse.
Yeah, no, what a lot of these trends normally do is people want to see, especially when you see your friends doing it,
yes,
you see these caricatures of yourself in your favorite medium. So maybe it's a show that you've watched before and you really want to see what you would look like, right? What your family would look like. And so you upload content or you share information on social media. So Facebook in particular tends to be a popular location for it. You share your information, you get this image, and you might share that out to others, and it kind of propagates from there. So as it becomes more and more interesting for all of your friends, they want to do the same thing, and more people use that service. And this has been not just for recent images that have come along for, you know, Studio Ghibli, I think, is one that I've seen a lot of people invest, I guess, their own images in to see what that content looks like. But this is a common trend for a lot of different services where you share pieces of your profile, pieces of your content from your Facebook account or Meta account or other social media account to get some kind of content back. And some of it can, you know, is really for just, this is interesting, I'd like to see what it looks like. But then the question is, for any of the services, what happens with the data that I supply to it? So if I supply my image, what does that mean for that image going forward? Is it only used to generate that content? Is it possibly freely available now that you shared it with this third party? And so each party is going to be a little bit different, and you really may not know until you look at terms of service, all the things that tell you what they might do with that content. A lot of those are also subject to change, so they regularly get updated, which you may or may not see. I'm sure everyone's in their inbox at one point saying, hey, our terms of service has changed.
Yes.
Most people are like, you know, I'd love to click on that and read, you know, the 10 to 20 pages.
My life is too short for this.
Exactly. But, you know, I tend to browse past that unless I'm really interested in those kind of things. I don't click on all of them, but I click on some of them because I'm like, ooh, what changed? And being able to see the difference actually between one and another is probably the more interesting piece than the entire terms of service itself. What was the thing that they changed? And maybe it was because a service got removed that is no longer needed, or maybe a service got added, or they're changing the way that they're actually sharing information, either internally within like subcontractors or outside. So that, you know, maybe they're using it to retrain other models or to be used to sell to others. So it's hard to know really what happens, but when people do give up images.
So when I upload a picture, it's not uploading an actual visual. It's uploading ones and zeros and what's included in that photograph that I upload that goes beyond just the red, green, blue of the photograph.
Right. And for a lot of providers now, and I'd say 5 or 10 years ago, it's going to be very different. So when you upload an image, you know, most people just think about the picture,
right?
You know, something, you know, I went to a store, I had film, I got it developed, I see a picture, right? I see the image. When something's taken in a digital form, it's very different. So if I'm taking it from a phone or even a digital camera, but a phone specifically is a lot more interesting because what usually gets captured in that image might be location data. It may be the information about the device used to record or capture that image. And so there's a lot more information that's actually put into that file, that image, that otherwise you wouldn't think of when we think about kind of traditional pictures and film.
Like the phone you used, the
right
location you took the picture, the time and date where that picture was taken.
Exactly. So they might know from GPS data that's actually within the image itself, I know where you were and when you were there just based upon that image. And a lot of companies like Meta and what they will usually do is try to remove some of that information, remove what they call metadata.
Okay.
So they don't store that.
Okay.
Once again, every organization is going to be a little bit different.
Right.
So some might use it for something. Some may remove that. So if it's shared internally from one service to another, that data may not be there to share. But if you share or upload your own raw image to one of these third parties, they might be able to still get that information, assuming it's baked into what device you're using. And so each device could be a little bit different, but there can be interesting information stored in that those image files.
Are there ways to cleanse the metadata from a photograph before using it or sharing it?
There are. And I was going to say there's online options to actually remove metadata. I think one of the challenges with that is, well, now you're sharing an image with all that metadata so they can remove it. Granted, you know, if you trust the service, maybe it's something you could do. Otherwise, there are options to actually do that locally. You can download very, very, and I would say very easy scripts, but, you know, for an IT person,
right.
it's easy.
What's a script?
Right, exactly. For most people, it might be a little bit more challenging. So a lot of times, if you're actually on your phone, there might be an option, when I take images, do not store this data.
Okay.
And so that would usually be the item I would look for. Usually it's going to be in a privacy setting. It might be in a camera setting, to actually just not store it, not record it at all.
Yes.
And if you're able to do that, that's probably going to make things a little bit easier. So then you don't need to think about that when you're uploading that content.
Jesse, you mentioned Meta. That's the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Those are all those three companies, at least for the time being. If I did not want to spend my life reading terms and conditions and updates to terms and conditions, is there a simpler way I can go about protecting my data before I use these apps and give them to my third parties?
Usually I would say it's a mindset. So one, I would say don't use them, just because if you're not quite sure about your content.
When in doubt, leave it out.
Exactly. Otherwise, you know, think about the data that you're uploading. Consider that every piece might be public knowledge. And usually I think about this when writing an email. Mm-hmm. So I work with a public institution.
Yeah.
I consider every email I write may be in the front news of the paper. That is just the reality based upon what can happen with
open
records requests.
We've seen emails like that on the front page of the newspaper.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So think about the same thing when interacting with a third-party company, where you're submitting an image or you're submitting text. Mm. Are you okay with that being not purposefully put out into the public, but what if there's a data breach?
Yeah.
Right? What's going to happen with that information if and when it becomes public? And so I think that can be another guide when thinking about a service. How much do I trust it? And if I'm giving it really, really valuable data, that trust should be much, much higher.
But that's also a good guide for how to engage and act online.
Right.
I mean, behave yourself, because there is no privacy online, or there might not be at some point.
Right. And especially with social media.
Yes.
It's not just the company that's collecting the information or storing it. It's your social network. It's the individuals that are on that platform. It could be your friends. And so while even a lot of people tend to keep their friend list short and try to make sure that only content is available from friends,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't mean that one of your friends still couldn't collect some of that information and misuse it. And so that's another challenge in itself. Do you know that every single friend or connection is someone you actually know? And there's a lot of bots on the internet, on these social media networks,
act like people, and you wouldn't know they're not people if they didn't, and they're not. It's not like they're going to tell you they're not people.
Right, exactly. Or what might actually happen is, you know, there's a profile that you trust. You've talked to them in person. You are connected on whatever social media application. But what if their account gets compromised?
They could get hacked.
They could get hacked. And somebody else could have access to that information. So I think that's another risk. And, I mean, we're living in a situation where we have a lot of online profiles. We have a lot of accounts. And it's just a matter of time till somebody gets into something. But you know, once again, what information do you want out there or not? If it's really private, if it is something you generally don't want shared,
yeah,
consider the way you're sharing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, having a physical letter you're mailing to someone versus posting it on a Facebook page, there's going to be different levels of availability for somebody to capture that information and be able to put it out somewhere.
Jesse LeGrew is our guest, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, and happy to take your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll start with Marlon in Madison. Good morning, Marlon.
Hey, good morning. I just started teaching part-time at Madison College, actually.
Cool.
So I retired from, and I'll keep it brief, I retired from MMSD, and then that was 5 years ago, where I had some issues about security on the internet. And people were very curious as to how was I able to live in a nice neighborhood where I live. And eventually, because I'm African American, it's a curiosity, because we're not supposed to live in really nice places. So the principal came out to my home and asked me the same question. How is it you're able to live here? You know, and I had to let him in the house and show him that it's a regular house. It's nothing strange or anything. He asked me, was I a drug dealer to be able to afford my home? I said, no. But because of he told people that I had such a nice home, other teachers started coming here. So I thought that curiosity was over 5 years ago. And then after my very first class, drawing one at Madison College, similar questions came up with my students on the very last day of class. And so they're like, how do you live there? Are you married? Do you have a wife? Do you have a husband? Do you have this? Do you have that? And then they showed me what they were looking up about me on the internet.
Oh.
And I was just so surprised that there was so much information out there.
Oh.
How do you clean that up? And can I do it for free?
Marlon, great question. Hi. So our information is out there, and people can find it, and they can search for it, and in some ways they can make assumptions or cast aspersions as a result of that. What can we do to clean up our presence online, Jesse LeGrew?
There's a lot of work that goes behind this, both if people want to do this manually, mm-hmm, which can be challenging, or there are some third-party services that actually people can purchase now. So unfortunately, with our data being out there, there's also business opportunities people see in terms,
sure,
of being able to sell a service to try to remove information from the internet. There's some things that are going to be easily accessible where you can request the removal of information. One of the challenges, especially within the United States, if you are in Europe, GDPR is a law that allows you to request the removal of your information. We don't necessarily have the same regulations or laws in place to help us currently. California does. A lot of other states are putting more laws in place.
How do those work?
Basically, they will require companies in certain areas. So if you're living in California, for example, you have more rights to request the removal of your information than you might if you were in another state.
So Marlon could go to a third party and say, would you please delete this information about me from your database? And they could say no.
Correct. So depending on the terms and service, once again, this is,
yep,
the challenging part, there might be some availability to do it. I would normally, I recommend this for everyone, Google yourself. It sounds like, Marvin, you've already done this, and so you're starting to see a lot of the information where people are housing information about you, usually within those, and it does take a little bit of digging. You can usually request the removal of information. Some services are more challenging than others to get that information removed, but usually there is going to be some kind of request process in order to do it. Worst case, you can also look into a third-party provider that you can actually pay to get that data removed. The big challenge behind it is if you remove your data today, and let's say you spent weeks going through removing information, and over months you've seen that data slowly trickle and shrink on your basically online presence, it's hard to know whether that data is going to pop up again. And part of the reason is a lot of data brokers will collect this information. They might remove it online, but it gets sold and resold all the time. And so people might actually have an older copy of the data. That data might get uploaded again. And so it's kind of a never-ending cycle of being able to make sure that this data is removed. So having a third-party service, I've never used any myself, so I can't state to the...
But how would they have any more luck as a third-party service that you pay for than you would yourself when there is no regulations or requirements that another party would have to remove that data?
Right. It's an excellent question. So part of it's the effort, because it is a lot of effort. So you're allowing somebody else to try to take that action for you, because it's continual. It is not something that, and I've done this. I did it when I also updated every single one of my passwords. I took a weekend and I did this whole thing. There are even workbooks you can go out there to just make sure you can, you know, freeze your credit and delete other information from online repositories. If you do have social media profiles, they might get data from there. So there's a lot of ways people and organizations can collect this information. And one, I'd make sure if you can identify where that information is coming from, close those accounts up. Make sure that privacy settings are enabled or disabled so people can't share that information, and then go ahead and clean everything up. Because if those sharing settings are still in place, you might remove it and then it might get re-added. Because
you might be the one repopulating the data.
Exactly. Yeah. So otherwise, make those requests. Once again, I have done it, but I've seen, you know, I think ZoomInfo is one common one where a lot of individuals look for professional profiles.
Yeah.
That data gets repopulated. I remember removing my information from a lot of different services. After a little bit of time, it'll likely pop up again, just depending on where that source data is coming from.
It's whack-a-mole.
Right.
It feels that way. Marlon, I wish you the best of luck. Don in Iron River's got a great question, but I need to take a minute here. If you've got a question for our guest, Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, join us, 1-800-642-1234, or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on WPR News. It's your Tech Update Monday on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. And coming up at noon, we revisit a conversation with Erica Majumder, UW-Madison Assistant Professor of Bacteriology, talking about the possible development of biodegradable plastic. That's coming up after noon on The Larry Mueller Show. But right now, it's your Tech Update Monday and your questions for Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or talk at WPR.org. Don in Iron River, you have a common question. Good morning.
Yeah, Don here. Say, I'm on the no-call list, and that works.
Sure.
But I keep on getting probable spam calls from people, and that works too because I can block the numbers. But what irritates me is I'm receiving text messages from politicians, and how the heck can I delete those and get rid of them?
Don, I do believe you are not alone in this, and the do not call list does not necessarily mean the do not text list. Jesse, do you know about this?
Yeah, and it can be very different. So, and part of the challenge is in terms of how that data is supplied. So a lot of it might be public information requests where people are gathering this information. And so some of the do not call might really apply to organizations rather than people. So you can't necessarily, you know, ban one person from calling another. Usually it's meant for solicitation, a lot of other things. And a lot of public information is usually gathered, could be from voter registration, for example, which is where a lot of that information will come up, and then it'll be reused in a variety of different ways. I've also gotten a lot of those texts, especially in the last year or two. I think it's been a lot higher than it has been normally, and the do not call really hasn't helped with that. The one thing I'm not sure about is if there is a way to limit the data sharing, but usually, once again, if this is an open records request to collect information from really the public, there might be limited things you can do in terms of how that data is handed over. Once again, this might also be assisted by laws that can help to regulate what data can or cannot be shared to third parties. Part of it, and that's really going to be a challenge for anyone that doesn't have the protection of legislation to help centralize that as well, mainly because we do have it state by state. It makes it really, really challenging. It makes it really inconsistent. And so the one thing I'd always recommend for anyone is to support the inclusion or creation of any kind of, and I would say federal, privacy laws to help limit the information that's being shared. I think it can help state by state, but something that can make it a lot more seamless from state to state will help limit the complications, because it's really complicated.
But what can Don do now? I mean, I've found that my tactic is to, when it says type S to stop, I type S and send it, or block it, or report spam, or, and I know, again, it feels like a little whack-a-mole, because that same message can come from a different number in a different place, but my best method at this point is to just identify it as spam, ask them to stop, and then block the number so it doesn't come back.
And generally, those would be my recommendations. I think one of the questions that comes up often, this is usually an email spam, should I click on unsubscribe?
Right.
Is the act of interacting with it potentially making me a better target in the future? Because I'm confirming that I actually
exist,
saw this
and I am engaging with you, and that could promote more engagement.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I usually tend to block the numbers. You can request the removal when you are given that option. You might unrequest it, then remove or block the call just to make sure you won't get any in the future.
Yep.
One of the challenging things, and this is kind of a technical piece of our telephone system, it is horribly insecure. And so being able to spoof or fake your phone number is really
easy.
So even if you are on or off different lists, there are ways to change phone numbers to circumvent, to get around any of those blocks. And even if you're on no lists, there, you know, people could try to text every number that they can guess in a certain location. So block them when you can. And if you do see other opportunities where people are putting up new privacy laws, you know, be engaged, give suggestions to help make sure those are in place to protect. Because right now, without having a lot of those to protect individuals,
we all have to individually act, and it feels like we're all doing something that a regulation or a rule could do for us.
Correct.
It'd make our lives a little easier.
Yeah.
Don, you are far from alone, and I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. Mark and Sun Prairie has two questions. Do the AI tools they use save any of his personal data? And Mark is also curious if there is a way to determine how much of their personal info has been obtained by the federal government, specifically the DOGE team in Washington.
Yeah, and that's a good question. So I think this is something that has come up a lot more recently.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, specifically for requesting information, you can do an open records request for yourself. You can actually try to collect that information and simply make a formal request because as a citizen, you have the capability to do that and see what information do you have about me. I've never done that myself. I know a lot of people who have done that process really to see what that information is. It's the equivalent, I guess, on a national level of Googling yourself. And so you can request the information and see what might come from that. I think a lot of open records or public records requests generally might have a price tag associated with it.
Right.
So usually there is time required in order to collect the data so it can be delivered. So you may have to pay a fee, but you could understand what information is being collected. The question is that I would have is, will it matter if the data is collected directly or if they're receiving the data from a third party? So since you can buy and sell information online very, very easily, and a lot of companies do this for marketing purposes and a variety of other reasons, it would not be surprising to have any kind of government agency also utilize similar data sources.
Sure.
To do other things. And it could be for marketing as well. It could be for so many other reasons. But they can also buy and sell some of that information, or at least purchase it from companies, because a lot of companies just, that is their business model.
When you make an open records request of the federal government, do they tell you what it's going to cost you in order to get that information? And does that cost give you some idea of how much information they have?
I don't know if it gives you the price tag up front. Okay. Usually that's something that depends on where the data needs to be collected from. Once again, I've never tried it myself, so I don't know if they have an upfront fee. I wouldn't be surprised if they had a price that changed based upon the, not necessarily the amount of data, but the location of the data.
Okay.
So depending on what had to be turned over, if one location is really, really hard to get in data from and it takes a lot more time and your information's in there, that price tag might increase. But if you don't have data in that really hard to get area, you wouldn't have to worry about that cost. So I would imagine that you're going to find out once more information is known in terms of where that data is stored.
Now, that's our federal government. Mark also has a question about the AI tools and whether or not they save any personal data. And one thing I've seen recently is Meta's new edition of their AI does seem to be collecting a lot of information and processing that as part of their large language model that, you know, what you give this AI in terms of your data can end up becoming part of their artificial intelligence. So how do we figure out, do the tools, AI tools, save any of our personal data?
Normally, if a service is free, I think that is a relatively good indicator in terms of risk. Mm. If the service is free, it's likely they're going to be profiting from the data in some way. That might be improving their services from the data they're collecting. It could be taking and reselling that data. It could be that and a variety of other things. But once you start paying for a service, usually you're getting a few different things along with it.
I've seen ChatGPT does come with you can pay for ChatGPT.
Yep, correct. So you might get more prompts, right? I can do 50 prompts a day instead of 25 prompts a day. You might also get more data protections, which means it will not either retrain your information or your prompts to be used for others in the future. It may exclude data being shared, and it's going to be different from each provider. And so that's the other challenge. Each terms of service is going to be different. You might have a free tier and three different paid tiers. If you're not on the right paid tier, you might still have that risk of it getting retrained. So in the end, the data is getting collected.
Yep.
The question is, how is it being stored long-term? And in the terms of service, does it note how that data is going to be reused? And it could be automatically reused by subcontractors. Usually they're going to need to abide by those terms and conditions. But there's a lot of weird little legal loopholes in terms of what applies to a subcontractor versus the company that hired the subcontractor.
So what's your recommendation in terms of interacting and engaging with AI? How does Jesse LeGrew, you know, answer the prompts that AI gives it?
Well, usually what I'll look for, once again, I kind of go by the same, how much would I care if this information became public?
Yeah.
And so if I'm using ChatGPT, Copilot, whatever AI service, Gemini, and I'm putting information into it and getting information out, how much do I care if somebody saw that? And if the answer is probably not at all or very little, then great. It sounds perfect. Once more sensitive information comes in, either because of what it replies or what I give it, then I'd want to make sure, is there a paid plan that makes sure that the data is not being used to retrain the algorithm, which means somebody else might be able to collect the information instead of directly sharing it, or is the data reshared or reused in any way? And with any online service, usually those are the things I look for in the terms and conditions. And if there's a paid version that says, if you pay, your data will not be reused, and that a lot of the marketing for these tools have really tried to make that incentive where if you pay us, we will not share your data. It is unfortunate that we have to pay to not share the data, but it does compel them to
there's
at least,
a value in that.
Yeah, there's a value in that.
Yeah.
So having a paid option, it can be useful. A lot of people right now, if you do have local computing resources available, so you have a computer that can run this well enough, you can create your own local version of it, which also means it stays in your device and you can limit what information is being shared. It does require some technical know-how and some experimentation, but a lot of people have done it. There's a lot of YouTube videos and guides that people have used to do this. So one, because people want to experiment with it.
Sure.
But they also want their own private version that they can train with their own data and doesn't go out to the internet.
My own AI?
Correct.
Ooh, I like the sound of that. Speaking of valuable data, 23andMe went bankrupt, collected a bunch of genetic material from millions of customers. 15 million, I believe, is the number. And now there is a question that when this company gets sold in bankruptcy, where does all that genetic data go? How does this bankruptcy affect the settlement in the class action lawsuit? And what can people do to claw back their genetic information?
Yeah, and so in this is not just for 23andMe. It would be for any company that might have your data.
But this is my DNA.
But this is your DNA. And so there's part of it. One is, you know, the digital ones and zeros that they take from the information you submitted, but as well as any actual storage of that genetic material itself. So yeah. There's kind of two pieces. And the best thing you can do, just like trying to get things off the internet, is request deletion. So the nice item for a lot of these online services is usually you have a delete or unsubscribe button, basically. I would like you to remove my profile and all of my information, including any genetic material you may have stored. Requesting the removal of any of that data so it cannot be reshared, resold, or given to whatever organization may purchase that data is probably going to be the best option you have to make sure, or at least lessen the likelihood that anyone else will get that information. Mm. So, and this goes for any service. So if you're using a service and you want to make sure, I'd like to make sure no one else can use this, request data deletion and that it not be shared. And most organizations will have that in the terms of service in that if you request it, they will delete it. And usually that will give you enough power, enough empowerment to actually get that data deleted. Because some organizations may say, well, you can tell me to delete your data. I might not delete it. But if the terms of service actually states it, that's support for you to actually go through that process. And that can be challenging back and forth depending on who you're talking to. But go to your online profile. There's usually a privacy or deletion setting and what that implies. Some people do like to have a separate email. Some people like to also have a separate physical letter where you're actually requesting it. It, once again, depends on the company, but usually in this case, that online deletion of data is what would be recommended.
It strikes me, Jesse, that you and I see the internet world a little bit differently. You as a chief information security officer, me as some guy just who goes online to have fun. And from your perspective, it seems like a lot more work to be able to protect yourself, your identity, and your data. You mentioned before that you spent an entire weekend changing your passwords. It made me think, when's the last time I changed my passwords? How often would you recommend that people do update their passwords?
It's a great question. And actually, there's kind of a guiding light a lot of people have been looking at for quite some time from the National Institute of Standards and Technologies, otherwise known as NIST for many of us in the industry. And it's stated over and over again, you know, change your password, let's say every 60 days.
What?
And there's a lot of organizations that would do that. The nice thing is those recommendations have finally been updated.
Okay.
And so generally they'd recommend changing your passwords less frequently, because one of the things we know is the more passwords you have, the more times you change it, the more likely you're going to write it down in a Post-it. You're going to have it in a text file on your computer or in a way that's going to be insecure. So make it a password that's generally over 15 characters. And most people recommend passphrases now. So even if you're thinking about, well, I need special characters, I need to have spaces,
right,
uppercase, lowercase numbers, generally now it is use a passphrase. So it's something you can remember. And then use that to get access to services. I like to use sentences because you can get change in punctuation and you can remember it a little bit easier, but also use a password manager. So you might have this, you know, long structured sentence, whatever it might be, passphrase to get into your vault, and then your vault gives you access to all your other passwords.
I had a password manager. It got hacked.
Yes.
That is so darn password managers. What can you do about that?
So, and there's a couple of things you can do about that. So one, if you do use an online service, double check to see what they encrypt and how that's protected. So even if some of the data might get exposed, it might limit who can actually see the data still. Otherwise, there are still local password manager options. You can install it and download it on your computer, and you can back it up somewhere else. That gives you more control. So you have that locally on your device. It's not shared with anyone else unless somebody breaks into your computer. Otherwise, I always say, if it works for you and you want to have a notebook and you want to write down all your passwords and you want to have it on your desk, you know, the risk.
That's
unless,
what my mom does.
Right. And the
and
risk.
She might be the smartest technological security officer of them all.
Yep. And so it works. They'd have to get into your house to get access to it. The challenge behind that is, do you know all your passwords are unique? So
right.
That's the other thing I'd recommend. That's where having a password manager can at least assist a little bit. You get a nice listing of all the services you're using. You can usually see quickly what passwords are being reused. And then given really generate complex passwords that you don't even have to know or memorize. So that's one of the reasons I do like a password manager, even if there is the risk of compromise. If that information is protected really well, it can really help keep track of all those passwords. And to your early question too, how often should I change mm-hmm. it? Really the recommendation is, one, make it a good, strong password. Use a longer passphrase. Once you've done that, enable multi-factor authentication.
Ooh.
So that's always a recommendation. So even if somebody has your password, at least in most cases, they can't get into your account. And only change your password if it's compromised. If you know somehow someone has gotten the password, if it's been leaked, if you see it on Have I Been Pwned, where I was using a service.
HaveIBeenPwned.com is a website. It is legitimate, and you can put your email address in there and find out whether or not it's been used.
Correct. And so, and it's Have I Been Pwned, and Pwned is P-W-N-E-D. HaveIBeenPwned.com. When you type in your email, it'll say, I've seen your email associated with these breaches. They might have gotten some data, and they'll usually tell you the data fields. If a password from that service was leaked, it's time to update that password
yeah.
because somebody probably has the information, especially if it wasn't protected well. Mm. But generally, change passwords less often. Make sure those passwords are unique. Enable multi-factor authentication when you can. And however you want to store your passwords, store it in some way where you can try to increase those chances of having a unique and strong password. Password vaults help a lot with this. And if you don't want that online one because you're a little unsure, you don't necessarily trust the organization as much, you can always use a locally installed one. Once again,
Or a notebook. Like my technical savvy mother.
Yes.
Madison College Chief Information Security Officer Jesse LeGrew is here to help us recognize scams and what we can do to protect ourselves online. He's also answering your tech questions at 1-800-642-1234 or by email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, Larry returns and he'll have health experts answering your questions. First, a psychologist, followed by a rheumatologist to take a look at arthritis and osteoarthritis, and finally, a dermatologist. All there for you tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show from 11 to 1 here on WPR News. Right now, our guest is Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, where he assists implementation strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data, but we're also talking about yours as well at 1-800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. And Jesse, you did have a spam removal tool that is available from the Federal Communications Commission that people might want to try?
Yeah, and so the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, does have options to help support removal from any of these kind of texting platforms that are generating texts. Another option actually is the Federal Trade Commission. So there's a variety of federal institutions that you can help to report the phone numbers
okay.
so that you can get those blocked or at least help the chances that you could also help others. So if you're able to get it unblocked from you, you might be able to help that from others. So reporting is a good first step.
You were also talking about multi-factor authentication, which is something you use in your work, I use at my work, and I think most businesses now require it in order to protect business networks from hacks. But I've also seen stories where folks have found ways to attack multi-factor authentication, and one of the big ones is MFA fatigue, which once I found out what it was, made abundantly, yes, that seems like something that could absolutely happen to me. What is MFA fatigue?
Yeah, and so there's a variety of different ways to use multi-factor authentication, and it's really just something outside of a password.
Right.
So,
it's like a text on your phone or an app on your phone that says, hey, are you trying to log in? Or even an email that could come in to say, we're just checking before we let you in. Is this really you?
Correct. And one of the, in this case, MFA fatigue that we're seeing is usually from an app you have on your phone where you might get an approve deny message.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get enough approve and deny messages in a very short period of time,
you might just
go ahead and say approve. Like, I don't want these messages anymore.
Guilty.
And that is the time at which somebody else may likely have access to your account.
Yes.
And so it's really taking that human factor in of, you know, somebody's going to be irritated enough where they're sick of hitting deny.
Yep.
They're finally going to hit allow, or they're just going to accidentally click it just because of frustration.
Or muscle memory. Like, I never click deny, so one time it could come through and it had nothing to do with me, but that's what I always click, so my thumb just goes there.
Yep, and so that's where that fatigue comes in. Generally, for a lot of the other methods, like SMS or text message, you might get a lot of text messages, but there's really nothing you can do with it. So it's not where you're going to hit yes to allow. You're just going to get a lot of text. But when you have one of those applications that prompts you, that's the time where that MFA fatigue might come into play. And somebody trying to get into your account, they might generate all those prompts. One good thing to know about that is if they're able to generate that prompt, it also means they have your password.
Ah.
Because they got through that first step likely. So if that's the case, that's also an account you want to change your password to make sure that no one else can get in. So while those attacks can be challenging and people can, you know, fall victim to that MFA fatigue, it can be a good indicator noting somebody else has my password. I didn't type my information into this. I want to go ahead and make sure I can update that.
One of the common themes in this last hour about online security from you, Jesse LeGrew, is the onus is really on us, that we bear personal responsibility for our personal information, that we have to take control of it, that what appears online and how many people have access to it and our security when we go on the internet really is all up to ourselves.
Yeah, and that's a big portion of it. I think a lot of locations try to make that a little bit easier on the individual as well. So we always have the choice to make what services that we're using online, but we could use some assistance from any kind of government we're sitting under, whether it's state or federal, to help protect what our information, how it can be used, making sure we have rights to remove or delete our information, and that a lot of other predatory practices to take, sell, or otherwise distribute information is lessened. And so GDPR was really successful.
That's the European laws.
Correct. To help make sure people had those rights so people could request, and those were
Have they been effective largely? Have you seen criticisms or blowback as a result?
I think it's helped to make sure there's a framework that people can abide to. And I think it's been successful in the fact that companies now have to think about this now. They have to make sure
that the onus isn't just on the individual at this point. It's shared at least to some degree. Got a call here from Helen in Little Chute. Helen, good morning.
Oh, good morning. My question is, I am going to be traveling to out west to some of the national parks, and I just recently heard about the fact that we can get a portable Wi-Fi router and stay connected with the internet traveling. Is that possible? I never heard of this before.
Great question, Helen. Jesse?
Yes. So you definitely can do this, and depending if you already have an existing cell phone, you might already have it built into your cell phone.
A hotspot.
If you do have a cell phone plan, I would contact your cell phone provider just to see what's available. A lot of times that hotspot feature, which used to be a really big premium over the last 10 years, has become more of a default, where you might have that capability to turn on your phone as a Wi-Fi router that other devices can connect to, whether it's your laptop, other phones, whatever it might be, and actually use that service. They usually will have limits in terms of how much data that you can use.
Well, and how much cell service you get in Yosemite.
Right. And so that's going to be the other question is, where are you going to be and what service providers are going to give you the best service in that area. And that's another area I'd probably take a look at. It may actually be on some of the websites for the national parks.
Sure.
I'm not sure. But if you have a service and you have a hotspot but you can't get connected, it's really not going to help you. So
so this isn't an internet connection as much as it's a wireless cell connection that operates or can connect to the internet.
Correct.
Now, when Helen talks about a portable Wi-Fi router, I'm not as clear on that.
Yeah, and depending on how you want to look at it, even when you have your hotspot on your phone, you're essentially having a Wi-Fi router.
Okay.
It allows your phone to connect to your cellular signal, and it turns your cell phone basically into a Wi-Fi router that other devices can connect to, and they share that internet connection. And a lot of the other hotspot devices are essentially the same thing, but they're in a dedicated package. They're only used for that. You can't make phone calls, but you can turn it on. It'll connect to whatever internet service provider is on the back end, and it shows up as a wireless connection that you can connect to. Maybe you have to type in a password, maybe you don't, and then you can use the internet.
So Helen would want to contact her cell provider, ask if there, or find out if there's a hotspot service that the cell provider has included as part of the her plan, and then make sure that she has a device like her cell phone or maybe another device that would operate as a hotspot for other devices to connect to the internet to through that wireless connection.
Yes, and the main thing to check with your cell phone provider, you may not have to pay anything. You might already have it without knowing it.
Or just data.
Yep. And if you don't have it built in, you can always get a different device from your cell phone provider, and there's a lot of other ones that are available in other locations to do that. So, yes, it's very much a thing. But, hey, maybe you already have it for free.
Yeah. Check on that, Helen, and thank you for calling. Have fun in Yosemite. With the time left, and we just have a couple minutes, Jesse, I also want to talk about something else you do for fun, and that is your volunteer work for the SANS Internet Storm Center. You're telling me a little bit about it earlier, how you set up honeypots and actually look for hackers or things that are looking to attack the internet. Share that a little bit with me.
Yeah, and so the Internet Storm Center has what they call honeypots that are available that anyone can really install at home or in other areas. That is basically a device that tries to tempt attackers.
You're looking for attackers.
So we're looking for attackers. We want individuals or bots or scanners to connect to these devices to understand what kind of attacks are happening worldwide, to analyze that data and to reshare that out.
And when you set up these honeypots, how often do you find things that fall into them? Nefarious malware and hackers and attacks?
Usually if I set up a brand new one
on
an IP address or a network location that hasn't been used, I'll usually see some kind of logs within a few minutes. And an interesting part about that is there's just something scanning the internet all the time. So even if it's not something bad where it's a bot trying to install malware, it might be Google because they're trying to index a lot of things on the internet.
Right.
Or it could be a variety of census-like providers that collect a lot of this data to share with other people who find it interesting. Shodan's a popular service where you can understand what's on the internet, and they also scan the internet all the time. And they're just one of many that are just scanning the internet all the time that you might see on these devices that may not be bad, but they can be a little chatty.
Yeah, so when we engage with the internet, I feel like we can go somewhere and find what we're looking for. We can use AI, we can upload pictures, but what the internet is doing in the back end at all times is indexing itself, looking for itself, that there is a lot more action happening through these wires than we can even wrap our heads around.
Correct.
Jesse, I want to thank you for providing that perspective of the internet for us today, giving us a different look at it, and sharing your wisdom about the online security, artificial intelligence, and our updated passwords. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse LeGrew is a Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College and also, as mentioned, a volunteer for the SANS Internet Storm Center, where you can set up your own honeypot, too. Coming up next, we've got a look at microbiology and the attempt to find biodegradable plastics in a landfill in Dane County. Erica Majumder talks to Larry Mueller in a recent fascinating conversation. That's next hour. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Larry's back tomorrow. You're listening to WPR News.
Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and our guest believes that much of the waste in our landfills, including a lot of single-use plastic, could be converted into renewable energy. Sort of a circular and sustainable bioeconomy, I think is how she puts it. And the she is Erica Majumder, who is an assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison. Her lab in the Department of Bacteriology is concerned with the mechanisms and the consequences of microbes on environmental and human health. And as we talk with her about some really cool research, she's got a number of projects going, and I want to try and touch on all of them. And we're going to start with some work that she's done with landfills, but you may have questions about bioplastics and microplastics, or those plastics that we call them single use. And that means that they get used once and they get thrown away. And she's trying to figure out ways that we can come up with a different kind of one-time plastic that can also be eaten up by microbes. Let's put it that way. As we talk with her, please do join in. What questions do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Erica, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, you work in the area called landfill microbiology, and it's kind of a new field, isn't it?
Relatively. I think it's gained new traction recently. There was a lot of good work in the 70s and 80s, but there hasn't been very much recently. But we've been reinvigorated to get back into this space.
Well, it involves studying microbes that are maybe deep in the bowels of landfills. What are you hoping to learn?
Sure. Well, a landfill is all about decomposition, and that's all done by microbes. And so we want to learn more about which microbes are there and what they're doing so that we can better control the degradation rates, maybe produce renewable energy, get rid of some of the contaminants, make space. Landfills are often filling up, and we don't want to use a lot of extra land for landfills. So there's incentives to have landfills work more efficiently as well.
And you and your grad students, a whole team of students, are doing something called bioprospecting at the Dane County landfill. And so bioprospecting, is that what you just described?
Kind of. We like to put a lot of different titles on things as the words get popular over time. But yeah, bioprospecting is this idea that in a particular environment where there are chemical constraints on the system, or a unique environment, you could call it, that the microbes that live there probably have adapted to have unique abilities that match that environment. And if we're looking for a microorganism that could help us do a particular function, we go look in environments that are chemically similar. So a landfill is kind of one of the craziest environments I've ever worked in. It's everything's in there. And so we were looking for microbes that might have some unique chemistries with degrading plastics or degrading some of the other wastes that are in a landfill that we don't see in a natural environment.
Yeah, it's really interesting. What I was reading the story about you and your work a bit, I thought back to a book Merlin Sheldrake wrote. It was titled Entangled Life. And in that book, he describes in one place where it involves some research in Mexico where I think 15% of or 10% of the landfill consisted of dirty diapers. And they came up with a white rot fungi that could eliminate 85, would love diapers, and produced actual edible mushrooms of a sort but reduce the extent of it by about 85% of the mass. And that's kind of what you're doing, we're looking to do anyway.
Yeah, in a way, definitely. There's a lot of great scientists who are coming up with innovative waste solutions like that, where we're using these natural processes that microorganisms have, which include fungi and archaea and bacteria and even viruses, how they all contribute to these processes. And so it's kind of looking at waste as food for the microorganisms and having those microorganisms produce something that's useful to us, whether that, like the example you just gave, where it's edible mushrooms or could be useful products, all kinds of different things.
Yeah. Well, the Dane County landfill, I have to tell you a little story about that. I did not like the Dane County landfill, where the location where it went in, because when I was a teenager, for a couple of years, I lived on the Rodefeld farm. And so I planted with a couple of brothers, Jerry and Dick Rodefeld, we planted about 1,000 trees in that property. I think I shot the first goose I ever shot hunting as a teenager. I shot in the little pond out in the back of that farm. But then it went to be it was sold to be a landfill, which I deeply didn't like at the time, because I thought, well, all the trees are now gone and everything. So, but I guess it has to go somewhere.
Yeah, landfills do have to go somewhere. And I think one thing that's really interesting about the Dane County landfill is that they do a lot to be holistic with it. So the closed part of the landfill, they actually use as a prairie seeding grounds. So they'll mm-hmm. seed native grasses to restore those on the closed part of the landfill. So they do try to use the space effectively.
And I'm a golfer, too, and now the other part of the landfill is going to go on part of the golf course that I play on all the time.
I did hear that, yes, that there were some golfers that weren't thrilled about the new location. But, yeah, putting a landfill in different places, you know, landfills are very essential to, you know, keeping, like, a healthy environment, but nobody wants the landfill, you know, in different places. So it's always a tricky discussion of where that goes.
Not my backyard kind of thing.
Exactly.
Well, here you are. Somebody, I probably was a reporter, or maybe not, coined the phrase for you as the landfill lady. What do you what do you think about that?
I've said before, I'm mostly okay with it. At first, I thought it was a little bit of like a Sesame Street Oscar the Grouch kind of reference. And I was like, hopefully it's not that. But then I was informed, I haven't seen Sesame Street in a while. I'm not. I was informed that Oscar recycles now and that he's no longer grouchy. So I needed to update my references there. But it's kind of nice to be associated with, you know, what you research and things like that. But the exact moniker, I don't know if I like it, but it was, I didn't realize they were going to use that for the title of one of the articles about me, but it's nice to be recognized, I guess, for what you do.
Well, let's talk about plastics for a minute here, because if you went to the Dane County landfill or any other landfill, you're going to find, you found a lot of plastic that hadn't degraded an inch, but I mean about 20%?
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources puts out waste audit reports of landfills across the state every year, those are all publicly available. And Wisconsin landfills on average are about 19 to 20% plastic.
And I think there was a little story you told about digging something. I mean, plastic you can dig up that was 30 years ago.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Parts of the landfill are about as old as I am, or a little younger. And yeah, there were plastics that I recognized from my childhood that were easily recognizable with
Hostess Twinkies
a brownie package. Yeah, specifically was one of them, and some face creams that I recognized from when I was a teenager. And you know, the blue of the packaging was still just immediately recognizable.
So wow, and so by the way, as well, we might also say that Wisconsin has a pretty big plastics industry
yes.
in the state, right? How big is it?
I should know those numbers. I don't.
It was over $2 billion.
Yes, it's very significant, which I was not aware of until I started working in this space. But yeah, it's a major industry here in Wisconsin.
And I'm told that about 45,000 people are working in the plastics industry in our state. So it's a big deal here in Wisconsin. So we can come up with ways to make better plastic.
Yeah, I'd be very excited about that. and I think also that's the way of the future. And the plastics companies in Wisconsin have been leaders and innovators for a long time. And so polymers are always changing in composition. As we've got new polymers over the decades, they've changed. What we use in our plastics change. And so I'm optimistic that plastics of the future will include a lot of these biodegradable solutions as well.
Fran in Madison has a comment or question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I observe many times when we're driving that the cement companies actually have grinders for concrete that they recycle. Why cannot be used to recycle, grind it down to as far as you can for all this garbage? I don't understand why the trucks dump loads and loads of it, and it can't be reduced to at least 50% of its volume by putting it through some heavy grinders. I mean, if they can grind cement for reuse, why can't we grind up all this
plastic
and cardboard? I mean, it's unbelievable when you go to that lab that circulates around. It's called Junk Lab or something.
The trash lab, yeah.
The stuff that actually goes in the garbage is just absolutely disgusting.
All right. Well, go ahead, Erica. Comment away.
Sure. Yeah. There's a couple of perspectives you could take there. I like that you're thinking about reuse for materials and how we might be able to replace new materials with what we already have. On the grinding question, so the landfills here, when the trucks dump things, there's a whole process of using these giant bulldozers that actually have metal wheels instead of rubber wheels, and they compact the trash, and there's a very specific way of compacting the trash, and so they're able to do that without grinding. Grinding consumes a lot of energy, so when we're looking at sustainability solutions, it's always this trade-off between how much energy and cost and the benefit to that. So for materials that go into landfills, the compaction that they do is probably more efficient in terms of than grinding. But I do like your question because that brings up a lot of things about waste diversion and what wastes go into landfills and how we can use those materials. So our local landfills here in Dane County, they do divert a lot of waste, like the construction and demolition waste diversion, the tire waste diversion. So they collect all of those materials separately and they reuse them and recycle them like you've seen with the grinding, which is great. And I wish we could do that more with plastics. There are some examples that I've heard about at some Wisconsin innovation things that I've attended where for road construction, they've been taking waste plastics and condensing them into large blocks and putting them under roads instead of extra gravel or dirt, which is more which is great that they're using these waste plastics in that way. And so, yeah, I'd love to see more innovation on that front.
For sure. And Dan and Brilliant, we'll get to you in just a minute, but we're taking a look at some research being done by Erica Majumder, who is our guest today, as she talks about her research, a little different than what we just talked about, because she's looking at bioplastics, which are a different thing kind of entirely from the petroleum-based plastics that currently go into these plastics that kind of live forever. And we'll talk about that. And Dan and Brilliant, we'll get to you in just a minute. But a quick reminder, you're listening to WPR News, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Erica Majumder, who is an assistant professor of bacteriology at the UW-Madison's Department of Bacteriology, doing some research in landfills, and especially zeroing in on plastics today. And I hope you'll join in. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And let's go to Dan and Brilliant. Dan, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was just tuning in. I'm actually a garbage man that frequents landfills pretty frequently. I'm on route right now, actually. And, yeah, these landfills are way more than just places where we dump our trash. And it's amazing to see the work that goes into these landfills and the science and research that's done even after the landfill is completely closed and all the operational side of things packs up. Scientists stay for decades after doing the work that you do. It's just, and it's such a great place for biodiversity, too. Like, one of the landfills I used to dump at when I worked on the other side of the state was a home for at least a dozen bald eagles.
Yeah.
And they never left. So it's pretty cool to see the difference in biodiversity and what animals are attracted to this
area. Yeah, Dan, thanks a lot for calling. Just a comment on that, Erica.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for the work that you do and for listening and calling in and your perspective on it. It's true. When I started working in the landfill, just thinking about the microbiology, I had no idea about all of the other infrastructure and really actually the incredible work and resource that a landfill is for a city and a locality. So, yeah. Thank you. And yes, the eagles are amazing. I also did not expect to see a lot of wildlife at a landfill. And yeah, the eagle watching at landfills is fantastic.
And seagulls.
Yes.
They come from everywhere.
The seagulls too. Yeah, I visited a landfill in North Carolina and they had a bunch of eagles there too. And I did not expect that. So,
thanks, Dan. I appreciate the call. Tom in Northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was listening in. I've got a couple of opinions. I was in the plastics industry for a good 40 years. I'm retired. I retired like 9 years ago, so I'm sure things have caught up a little bit. But I was pretty involved in recycling and things like that. And one of the problems, I think the biggest problem is there's no streams out there. The streams to get rid of the plastics, I used to feel the same way. I mean, we were fortunate in the sense that we were doing food-grade plastic, and so our rejected plastic, you know, was, you know, minute little particles of contamination stuff, so they could take that plastic and easily make something else out of it. So we had a stream for our waste. But the biggest problem is that people just there's not enough of industry for recycling and getting the streams going and separating your plastics. Europe is way far ahead of us than in that regard. They've been recycling for a long time. They are probably making more things out of their products, but we have to come up with ways. You know, we did some experimenting with trying to get plastics to degrade. You know, guys would take them home and bury them in their garden for a year and stuff and dig them up, and yeah, they weren't much different. You know, it's a hard thing to do, and I don't know how much has progressed in the last 9 years, but to me the more important thing seems to be, let's take the plastic we already have and find uses for it in recycling. And it was always crazy that when you would recycle, things would be so much more expensive. It's kind of like, well, geez, the main portion of the product that you need, you're getting, you know, you're almost getting for free. Why is it so expensive? But I know the process can be expensive.
You know, that's what you're working on in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Erica.
Yeah. Thank you for your comment and your perspective. I completely agree. I think there's an abundance of material available, and it's disappointing to me that we don't capitalize on all of that material that's available. And sometimes, as you were alluding to, even when there is a feasible chemical or engineering solution, sometimes the economics prevents us from using that, and then it just ends up in a landfill, which I agree is a shame. So I have recently in the last few years, I've seen more of an emphasis on people starting to get creative about the different ways to use plastics. And I mean, plastics are a super useful material. That's why we use them all the time. They're very practical, and I think there's a lot of creative uses for how we could recycle and reuse the plastic material that's out there.
And now what you're looking at, though, is the creation of, well, you would like to see plastics made from organic material.
Yeah, ideally. So I would say both ways. So existing plastic waste or, but my lab's done a little bit of that. We've done some waste PET or polyethylene thiophthalate, like water bottle kind of plastic conversion. But we've done a lot of work on taking the leftovers from food production. So we don't want to mess with the like the crops or the part of the crops that go to food, but there's all of that plant that gets left over, or there's all the animal waste that gets left over, or as those raw materials become the part of the food that we eat, there's other waste streams that come off of that. And so we've been trying to use all of that carbon and feed it to our microbes and produce biodegradable plastic polymers.
And the problem has been with a biodegradable polymers is that they're not as rigid, or they're I think the petroleum based are sturdier. Is that, am I right on that or not?
It depends on the polymer. So for a lot of the bioplastics, the main type of polymer is called a class called polyhydroxyalkanoates, or PHAs for short. And the main one that's produced commercially right now is called PHB. And it's a good replacement for polypropylene, but it can be a little brittle. And so it has very limited applications because it can be so brittle. So you can't do it for anything flexible like food packaging or things like that. So petroleum-based polymers have this wider range of mechanical properties that can be used. And so we try to, we've been actually sourcing some different types of waste streams from the dairy industry to try to make our bioplastic polymers be more flexible by incorporating some of the molecules that are in dairy waste.
Yeah, whey, I think, or a part of whey.
Whey is one of them, but specifically the acid whey we've been using, but you can also use sweet whey. And one of the great things about moving to Wisconsin is I've learned so much about dairy processing as well. And so sometimes we've been even trying with different streams like permeates and buttercream separated whey and all these different kinds of things that I didn't know existed. But the
But using them as a way to make this new product?
Yeah, exactly. So these would be like waste streams for the companies, or co-products or residues is typically what we call them, not waste streams. They are great food for our microorganisms, but less good food for people or animals. We feed them these molecules and our bacteria produce polymers from those molecules.
Mike in Madison has something that relates to just what you said. Mike, let's go there. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, so as we head into all these plastic cars now, and especially the electric cars that are like 80% plastic and going to fill up our landfills, quadruple the amount in the next 20 years, my question is there specific types of plastic that this bacteria prefers to eat? Any of our like nylons or of the poly blends? I know there's a couple different bacteria that around the world that I've read about that are eating up these plastics, but they never say they never get to too much technical data on what are the plastics are they eating? Are they prefer, you know, Lycra, nylon, the infinite number of plastics we have in the planet now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That brings up a lot of issues with plastic degradation. So yeah, plastics are a huge chemical. There's so many different types of plastics, many different polymers. They can be in blends, they can be in layered packaging. So it's a very challenging degradation as well as chemical recycling problem. A lot of times they don't say which plastics the microbes are eating because sometimes they don't know, or they maybe don't want to admit that when plastics get formulated, it's not just the polymer. There are these other small molecules that get mixed into the blend that becomes the plastic to give it the correct properties, and we call these other molecules additives. And what we found in our research and from the microorganisms in the Dane County landfill is that they're dominantly consuming these additives that are in the plastics, and they're not really eating the polymer. That can be tricky for a couple of reasons, but there are some microbes that can eat particular polymers. Microbes have been pretty good at eating PET, or the polyethylene terephthalate, from water bottles is the most common use of that. And they're pretty good at eating things that are like polyester based, so things that are labeled as biodegradable or home compostable plastics would be made out of polyesters. Microbes are less good at eating things like nylon or olefins, which would be like polyethylene and polypropylene, that have carbon-carbon linkages in the polymer. Sorry, I'm a chemist. I went down that route, but
that's all right. That's all right. Mike, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Again, I was thinking about some research. You know, these organisms can learn how to like something and to use it, and it sometimes takes a while. And I remember some research. A guy was, for some reason, decided that with the millions and billions of cigarette butts and filters, he taught. Well, he got working with microbes and found some that just loved them and ate them up.
Yeah.
But it took a while. It took a week or a couple of weeks for them to sort of warm up to the idea of eating them. But once they did, they just were ravenous.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the cigarette butts, I think it's actually a similar one to the diaper. It's the same microbe as the diaper example that you gave. But yeah, microbes can learn how to do these things. And that was one of the reasons we were looking in the landfill, is because there's a time element where the microbes have that time to learn how to do something.
Very cool. David in northern Wisconsin will give you a chance. Hi, David.
Hi. Hello. I called because it was several years ago, maybe two, three, something like that, where I saw a video on the internet, or else it was an article that I read, where somebody had a invention where he returned the plastic to its original oil composition, and it was something like in an African village, and then they were using that the product there for their utilitarian uses in that area. And I was wondering if the lady, I don't know her name, I just tuned in later, knew anything about it. And I've always wondered for these several years, ever since I discovered or learned about that, if we can so easily, because it wasn't a very complex process going on there, if we can so easily turn the plastics back into original composition oil, petroleum that it was made out of, why don't we do that?
Erica, what do you think?
good question. I'm not familiar with that particular example, but it sounds fascinating. There's even here at UW-Madison, there's a whole center. The acronym is CUP, for chemical upcycling of waste plastics. And so we do think a lot about that. And it would be great to have plastics that we could convert back into their oils or use. My guess is that would have been a very particular type of plastic that they were using, but I'm not familiar with the process. But 100% agree, we should do more of that.
David, thank you. Alex in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Erica. Thank you for this conversation. It's fascinating. The past 10 or 15 years, I've been hearing not just about microbes, but also fungi. Came in late to the conversation here, but I'm very curious on where that direction is going with using different mushrooms and mycelium, and if there's any benefits for using bacteria versus a fungus like oyster mushrooms and other types of mushrooms that I have heard to break down different types of polymers, but also styrofoam as well.
Yeah, thank you. We think a lot about this, actually. So in our research and others from around the world, what we've been seen is that if you want to fully break down a plastic, that you would need multiple types of microorganisms working together as a community or functional guilds, if you wanted to use labor analogies. And fungi are a huge part of that. Fungi are really good at breaking down bigger structures. And so bacteria are specialists in small molecule metabolism, and fungi are much better at breaking down larger structures. And so we kind of envision a scenario where the fungi would be breaking the plastics down into small enough pieces or releasing the smaller molecules. Fungi are much better at depolymerization, particularly for big intact plastics, because those are big plastics are too big to go inside of a bacteria. And so that means any of that breaking down part, at least initially, would have to happen outside of the cell, which is a very challenging problem for a bacteria. But fungi are much better at that. Examples are like the white rot fungi. Those are the fungi that break down like trees when they fall in the forest. Those mm-hmm. have a lot of the same enzymes that can help us break down polymers. And then once those polymers, and even the same way a log degrades in a forest, the bacteria then eat the smaller pieces that the fungi have broken down. So it's a team effort.
A team effort. Alex, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Dennis had emailed to say they've heard about microbes consuming oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico. Are these similar chemicals?
They are, yeah. Great question. So petroleum-based plastics are just oil that have been crystallized. And so and microbes, many different types of microbes, fungi, bacteria, archaea, are capable of depolymerizing oil. The challenge, and so the same metabolism in theory should work. The challenge is with plastics that since it's been formed into this hard, rigid, smooth structure, the enzymes that the oil degrading microbes use can't access the correct geometry to do the chemical reaction that they need to break it down. So that's the challenge of the plastic, is that you have to release the polymer to be free enough for the chemistry to happen. But yes, the oil degrading microbes could very easily act on plastics if we can get around the crystallinity.
John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. So last night I was watching a program. It was a response, an ex-executive's response from Amazon, who was working on or trying to get the company to pay attention and do a lot to destroy these plastics. And Amazon resisted, whatever. And the same, and they kind of went after Apple, too, because of all the disposable sort of turnover with these products that can't be recycled. And it was very interesting that Amazon did, after a while, and I don't know how long, but is making a concerted effort that in 10 years all of its products will be degradable. I just thought that I would share that, and it was a very interesting thing to watch, and I don't know which channel or which whatever, but I think someone did a look up and said Amazon's attempt at degradable plastics or something, might get that information.
Yeah, John, thanks for calling. Erica, are you familiar or aware of that work?
Not that specific one, but there are a number of larger companies that are starting to make these promises, or we've already seen reductions in packaging, or trying to think about using less plastic in the packaging. And I think all of this is part of the puzzle to the solution. So I'm encouraged to hear that other companies are making those promises, and some of the bigger players in the field.
Well, I would think that maybe the kind of bioplastics that you're working on might find a use in something like, you know, what you get from Apple, for example.
Yeah, exactly. That would be the hope.
because it's not I mean, you get the box, you open the box, all these little plastic pieces are in there, but they're centered in holders, kind of, so the brittleness factor wouldn't really make any difference, I wouldn't think, or maybe make minor difference.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of applications where the properties of existing bioplastics could already replace petroleum-based plastics. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, well, if I use a biodegradable plastic, does that mean my material isn't going to be stable? Like someone brought up cars or things like that. Cars, of course, get exposed to weather, and you don't want your car melting during the lifetime that you're driving it. But a lot of the reassurances that to have the biodegradation happen, it has to still be a pretty specific situation where you have a high enough concentration of microorganisms that are in a still environment that's warm, you know, for quite some time. So I don't think we're at risk of, you know, these, if we went to bioplastics, of them degrading on us. But yeah, there's many applications where we could drop in, replace bioplastics right now.
Erica Majumder, our guest today, Assistant Professor of Bacteriology at the UW-Madison's Department of Bacteriology. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Erica Majumder, an Assistant Professor of Bacteriology at the UW-Madison, talking about the research that she is doing relating, I guess you could call it landfill microbiology in a way.
Yeah, I sometimes say waste management microbiology.
So. Waste management, yeah, that's a good term for it. Steve in Oneida County has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Erica and Larry. Great show. Learning a lot. Right now on the DNR's website, on their mining website, there's plans for a company to drill some holes in our national forest, the Shawamakon Forest. And in their plans that everybody can read, it says that they're going to attempt to bury these sulfuric acid fragments in the forest floor and then bury them or put a tarp over it and do some crazy abandonment stuff. But they say if they hit groundwater, they'll move this material and take it to a landfill. And just thinking from common sense standpoint, if you bring like it's something like 75,000 pounds of acidic waste per project. If they take that to a landfill and dump that in there, wouldn't that burn a hole in the liner underneath the landfill and maybe harm this bacteria that you've been talking about? Or is there even a landfill in the state of Wisconsin that would allow high acidic rock fragments like that from a drilling project?
What do you think, Erica? We've strayed a little bit in some ways, but...
Yeah, I can attempt to partially address that question. It's a little bit out of my area, but there are hazardous waste landfills. So depending on how acidic that pH is, it may qualify for one of those, or they may need to do some pretreatment to the material before it gets deployed. But I can tell you from our work and from some of the stuff that my graduate student who leads the project, her name's Damayanti Rodriguez Ramos, she and I have been observing that there are a lot of microbes in the landfill that consume sulfate and sulfuric acid. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the natural sulfur metabolism processes that happens in any subsurface environment. And so, it would depend on exactly what that material is and which landfill it's going to. But it would be very far away from the liner, usually, in terms of the physical nature of how a landfill is constructed.
Steve, thanks again. Bruce in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Larry, thanks for taking my call. I've been having lunch with you since the mid-1980s, on and off. Have you guys mentioned the incinerator at La Crosse, where XL Energy has been taking energy out of garbage for decades?
We haven't yet, but let's talk about it. Bruce, thanks for calling. Erica?
Yeah, thank you. We hadn't quite, no one asked about waste incineration yet, which thank you for bringing that up. That's one of the other sort of emerging waste management situations. And I've been a Wisconsinite for around 4 years now, so I'm still learning all of the processes here, but I've always been impressed with what I learn and really seen that Wisconsin has been on the cutting edge of waste management strategies for a long time. And productive uses for it towards energy, which is great. And yeah, that incinerator in La Crosse is one of the other examples. I believe, I don't know the specifications of it, so I won't try to comment, but in general, there's been globally for places where either landfilling is not an option or landfills or are full or for other reasons that they've been moving towards these pyrolysis unit waste incinerators, which means they take all of the trash and they put it in and they burn it essentially, but at very high temperature and pressure. So it's not conventional burning. So you don't get the same type of toxics off gassing that you would from burning something. And they capture the heat and energy that's coming off of these pyrolysis units. And it's a different way of making renewable energy from trash. And so that's, I don't know a ton about that, but it is an emerging area that we've seen more and more municipalities going to globally as landfilling becomes less prominent.
And today, methane produced at the Dane County landfill is processed and converted, isn't it, into natural gas?
It is, yeah. We're one of the nation's leaders in that. So a few years ago, they installed a renewable natural gas plant at the Dane County landfill. And there are these wells that just look like big pipes, and they collect all the gas and they funnel it on site to the renewable natural gas plant. It cleans up the gas and pumps the methane into an interstate pipeline for natural gas. And so, it's revenue generating for the landfill. And also, farmers have the opportunity to bring the biogas that's produced from their manure piles. And so they can pump it just like a gas station in at the renewable natural gas plant as well. So it comes, that energy comes from the landfill and from our farming community, which is fantastic.
And, you know, that gas is used for vehicle fuel. Is it kind of a model of the larger bioeconomy that you envision could be built?
Definitely. Yeah, I think. I think these types of waste to energy conversion projects are great because, yeah, we're using this energy instead of just venting those gases into the air, which is not good for a lot of reasons. And yeah, we like to see this type of circularity where the carbon gets used for energy, it gets used for other products instead of just being released or buried.
So. Yeah. Paula in Fitchburg, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Paula.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about black utensils. For the last 2 days, I've gotten on email notices that the black plastic cooking utensils contain a fire retardant and they should be thrown away and replaced with stainless steel or maybe silicone. And I'm wondering what you know about that.
Well, do you know anything about that, Erica?
I think you might have seen the same article that my mom texted me the other day. I don't know specifically about that. I haven't read the article yet that my mom texted me, but I believe it has something to do with the presence of PFAS or these forever chemicals, the per and polyfluorinated alkyl substances. But beyond that, I can't say. But I think if the warning came from a manufacturer, things like that, then you would want to be. But yeah, I can't comment on that one specifically. I'm sorry. I don't know.
Okay. Paula, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I want to turn a little bit to some of the other research that you're doing, because you're looking at microplastics microplastics may absorb contaminants such as disease-carrying pathogens. What's the work you're doing there?
So we started doing some work with plastic contamination and the environment also. We have been working in different Wisconsin lakes, and we had some ideas that as we've started to see an increase of harmful algal blooms in many, both in the Great Lakes and inland lakes here in Wisconsin. And we also have started to see an increase in, they still call them marine debris, even when it's in a freshwater lake, but
yeah.
Marine debris just means trash in lakes, which includes microplastics. And we know that the organisms that cause harmful algal blooms can form biofilms on substances. And so we were wondering what would happen if you have these increases of HABs and these increases of trash, if that would cause an interaction between the microbes and how that might change toxin production or toxin absorption, or if that would stimulate more bloom growth if they had these surfaces to grow on. So we've been doing a lot of experiments in the lab to try to answer those questions.
That's pretty cool. And you're also doing some work on whether the chickens sold at grocery stores have microplastics and salmonella in them.
Yeah, kind of. Not quite at the grocery store level, more on the more on like the animal production on side of it.
Of things.
Yeah, more on the animal husbandry side. And so, yeah, we work with some in the collaborators in the meat science program for that. But some of the implications might be that there have been packaged meat recalls because of the presence of plastics. And so we were wondering if similarly, like I was mentioning with the harmful algal blooms, salmonella can also form biofilms on things. So we were a little worried, or we had some research questions about if you had plastic contamination, could that further seed a pathogen like salmonella, which likes to form biofilms on surfaces? So
you're doing a lot of weird stuff. Well, yeah. You're even working in the Wyoming aquifer, for goodness sakes, to clean the uranium waste?
We work with some hydrogeologists at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and one of our field sites is an aquifer in Wyoming that has uranium contamination from a former mining site. So when he was asking about the sulfuric acid with mining, I've definitely experienced that before. The site in Wyoming we work at has a sulfuric acid plant on site. And so I'm very familiar with how that gets infiltrated into the groundwater. We have some hypotheses there about how the microbes are controlling like the mineral formations around the uranium, which has been preventing the remediation strategy from being achieved at that aquifer. And so,
who funds all your work?
Lots of different places. So we have some funding from NSF, or the National Science Foundation. We have funding from USDA on the bioplastic work, so the United States Department of Agriculture. We've had a little bit of funding from the Department of Energy on the plastic to bioplastic work, and then as well as several agencies within Wisconsin.
And I was just thinking about the UW-Madison. What are we, fifth in the U.S. in the amount of research dollars that we
Oh, yeah,
are?
That was just announced today. I think sixth, but we can say fifth, but I think sixth officially.
Sixth is pretty good. The five above are pretty well-known places. But you and others here at the UW are doing some really outstanding research that has very practical application. As well, there are plenty of theoretical research going on too, but your work is very practical in the end, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it spans the fundamental research to try to answer these big picture questions. That's my interpretation of the Wisconsin idea, at least.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Erica, talking with you today. I hope we can do this again. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun. I'd be happy to come back.
Erica Majumder is an assistant professor of bacteriology at the UW-Madison's Department of Bacteriology. It's great to have her with us to talk about her work. And, of course, it's always great to have you listening in, and it's great to have the team that we have here for this program. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And me, I'm Larry Mueller, and I thank you so much for listening, and I hope you stay with us, because there's lots more in store here on WPR News.